My castaway this week is a comedian. In his long career, he's achieved many things, appearing in musicals and films, writing books, recording best-selling albums, and hosting religious programs on television. But one period in his life stands out above all the rest, both for him and for those who've enjoyed his performances over the years. It was the time when he and three friends put together a radio show not long after the war. It became a classic, anarchic, ridiculous, and very, very funny. It was called The Goon Show. He's since been knighted for his services to entertainment, but those goonish days remain, professionally anyway, his happiest. I still have the image of myself as Neddy Seagoon, he says, a demented idiot running around in manic fashion. He is Sir Harry Secombe. And you've even got the goon on your coat of arms, haven't you, Sir Harry?
Yes, I think it's best to call me Harry, don't you, under these circumstances, Sue?
But is it goon or go on?
Well, it's go on. Actually, when you knighted, you become what they call an armigerous. And you have to go along to the College of Arms to sign in. And they decide then what sort of you have on your coat of arms. So I had swan for Swansea, sword for represent the army, with a mask of comedy on it. Then a mermaid combing her hair, seacorn. All clever stuff, you want to say. And then a merman with a conch shell to represent music. And underneath, the motto, go on, which sends it all up.
So you got it all on there.
Yeah.
But why were those days the happiest? Was it just that they were so successful, or was it something more than that?
They were fun to do. I mean, we all pursued our individual careers all through the Goon Show, but we got together on a Sunday. We're like kids being let out of school. It was fantastic, all these things we could do. And the BBC, in their infinite wisdom, allowed us to experiment.
They got cross with you sometimes.
Now and again, yeah. Poor old Milligan was always fighting them off. The BBC executive. There was a planners meeting after it had been running about 2 years, I think, and a senior producer got up and said, "This go on show, what's it all about? Who are these go ons?"
And didn't Sellers once impersonate the Queen and got you all into hot water?
He did, yes. And he also he was stopped impersonating Winston Churchill as well.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it wasn't political or social.
No, it was apolitical. And the thing was,
it was just silly,
topical.
Really, wasn't
it? Was stupid. It was an oral cartoon. But there were some great, profound things in it. Like, I mean, I found echoes at the bottom of about a 15-mile deep trench or something. I said, "What are you doing here, Echoes?" "You'd everybody's got to be somewhere." He had profound thought that, you see.
But was it Milligan who was, at the bottom of these flights of fancy, primarily?
Yeah, we rode on the thermal currents of old Milligan's imagination.
But Bentine and Milligan didn't get on, did they?
Well, they got on, but there was a resentment because, we're all firing sort of jokes at each other, and somebody would say something, and it would be taken up by another one. And especially with Spike and Mike, they'd enlarge on a theme, and both would go away thinking the whole thing was his, whereas really he's an amalgam of the other fellow as well. So there was a little resentment.
I got the impression that you were the peacemaker in many ways.
I was in a way.
You were the only sane one around there.
I was the heaviest one there, so keep me in order.
Tell me about your first record.
Well, I've picked Peter Sellers singing My Old Dutch because it epitomizes Old Sellers. It starts off nice and sweetly and then turns rather nasty at the end, very funny. And when he stood next to him at the microphone, I mean, physically, he shrunk for old Henry Crank. And he blew himself up for Blood Knock, and he shrank again for Blue Bottle. He became them. He was such a... He had no voice of his own, if you know what I mean. When Spike would say to him, when the script was being read, "Use your own voice here," he said, "I can't, mate, I can't." He couldn't do it. He'd have to hide behind a character.
I called a shell. A proper name is Sarah. And you may find a girl as you'd consider fairer. She ain't an angel. She can start a jawing till it makes you smart. She's just a woman, bless her heart, is my old girl. We've been together now for 40 years, and it don't seem a day too much. Oh, there I am. A lady living in the land. As I strut before my dear old man.
Al 40 jaar. Ik heb je net ontmoet. Ik laat me die jou niet voor de gek houden, onbeschoft Engelsman.
Get back in the kitchen, you rotten old Dutch person.
Peter Sellers singing My Old Dutch. You have, Harry Sikkim, a wonderful voice yourself. You always have had.
A
bel canto tenor. But when and how did you discover that you had it?
Well, as a lad, I was in a choir, you know, from the age of 7. So all my life, really, I've been interested in music.
And you used to sing when you performed, didn't you, in those early days? Didn't you sing a duet with yourself?
Oh, yeah, in those days. I used to do Sweetheart, 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 la la la. One of those, you know, all classic stuff I did.
But at some point, you discovered a singing teacher who said, hang on, you should take this more seriously.
Yes, I did. I was doing Educating Archie, and I was to sing on it. And I was to sing out a tune. And Wally Ridley, who was then the sort of musical advisor for the program, said, you better go and get that varsity horse trained before you lose it. So I bought a chair and a whip and I went and some newspaper. Anyway, I went along to see this wonderful old maestro called Manlio de Veroli. And he took my voice apart like a mechanic. You know, and he used to say, please, Harry, don't go cross-eyed in the middle of this aria.
You say he stripped it all the way down. Did you put it back together again?
Well, yeah, what he did was get me to use my diaphragm rather than sing from the back of my throat. You know, you get a column of air comes up and you use that as up into the cavities and the head resonances, and that's where you produce the voice.
But this was while you were already recording The Goons. Did he suggest to you that you should stop that, maybe, and be serious?
He told me how to produce my voice so I wouldn't hurt the chords.
I see.
So I did all the Goon show. Hello, folks! Almost like recitative in opera. Hello, Jim! All up there, you see. Instead of going, like we're talking now, quite hoarse, actually.
I see. What, just from the throat, as it were?
Yeah, so it's up into the head.
But did you ever think, I'd rather like to be a serious singer?
At one time, yes, I fancied myself as a bit of a... And I always wanted to sing the big roles, because he got me to learn the aria antiche, the old arias, like by Gluck and people like that. Where you have a phrase which you have to sustain. And you keep doing that for a couple of weeks. And I'd be dying to sing On With The Motley or something, or On With The Mozzers or whatever. But he used to say, no, get it right first. Get the diaphragm working properly. And then you can let fly. Mm. And he saved my voice, actually, because I would have lost it without any doubt.
And have you still got it?
It's still there. I was doing Pickwick up until February, and in that, the top C's.
Mm. And so you can still hit the top C's. Tell me about record number 2.
Record number 2, Gigli, Beniamini Gigli. Can I met Gigli because Manu de Veroli, the aforementioned, was a contemporary of Gigli's at the Academy of St. Cecilia in Rome. And I met Gigli with him a couple of times. The last time was at his last concert at the Albert Hall, and I was taken backstage to see him. And I was thinking, I'll remember all my life what Gigli says to me, you know. And he had this dressing gown on and a towel around his neck, and he wasn't feeling all that well. And all I could hear him saying was, "Piacere, I'm pleased to meet you." And that was it, because he spoke in a whisper to the maestro all the time. And I was rather sad about that, you know. I hoped for some message from him, like, keep it up, lad, or pack it in, lad, or something. Anyway, I appreciate his singing, because he's the perfect bel canto.
Oh!
Beniamino Gigli singing Your Tiny Hand is Frozen from Puccini's La Bohème with La Scala Orchestra conducted by Umberto Berettoni, and that was recorded in 1938.
Was it? Yes.
Tell me about this fun-loving family of yours. Who were they and what was their fun?
Uncle George, he was the tap dance, taught me to tap dance. George Charles, he was married to Marjorie Charles, my father's sister, who was the beautiful redhead, used to play the piano in Woolworths, selling sheet music. You know, they put the sheet music in front of me, they wanted to buy it, and she'd play it. There was my Uncle Siddle, used to play the saw. He had a saw, ordinary saw, which he used to hold between his knees, and he used to whack it with a drumstick and produce sounds like a soprano singing. And nearly was, because that saw was quite sharp, you know.
But you, in the middle of all of this, apparently, were excruciatingly shy.
I was very shy.
You couldn't perform in front of them.
My sister was the funny one in the family, Carol. Still is a very funny girl, Carol. And when we had sort of parties at Christmas time and weddings and all that sort of thing, we all did a turn. But I was too shy to perform. This was in my gran's place in Jersey Terrace in St. Thomas. And I'd go outside to the outside toilet and sit there with the door open and sing. That was my part. What an idiot.
As long as they couldn't see you and you couldn't see them.
I couldn't see them, you see, so I could sing. The neighbours thought I was mad.
But you apparently went on stage with your sister and did something called a little turn called a Welsh...
Yeah, the Welsh courtship. It was a thing, Ted and May Hopkins, a Welsh double act, years ago, and they made a little, they made a record. And we learned it off by heart. And I was the stooge. She did the funny parts, and I was stooge to her.
But how could you do that if you could only sing in the lav? I mean, how could you go on stage?
I wasn't singing. I was just...
So you could go on the stage and perform?
Because I took my glasses off. I realised if I took my glasses off and I couldn't see the audience, I had more confidence.
And you've never seen an audience since. But what did you think, you know, as a young boy, a young man, that you were going to do with your life? How did you think you were going to earn a living?
Well,
because you wanted to perform.
I wanted to perform. I did sort of local concert. I used to do impressions of the vicar. I get thumped as well. I did impressions of everybody, the milkman, the milkman's horse. But I had to get to work because we lived on a council estate where everybody was, you know, no good trying to keep up with the Joneses because everybody was called Jones around there. And anyway, I had to get out and do something. The war started, and well, before the war started, I joined the Terriers. That was in April 1939, because the war was coming, pretty obviously.
The TA?
132nd Field Regiment. And my number was 924378. Bows and arrows we had in those days.
Tell me about your next record.
In those days, on the council estate, most of the social activity, you know, was around the church hall and the church itself. And as I was in the choir, I loved singing hymns. Hymns have always been my favourite for some reason. I wake up in the morning with a hymn in my mind. Not always the same one, you know. Honestly, shave to breath. Onward, you cut yourself with onward, Christmas soldiers. You've got to be careful with that one.
You can open your mouth too wide.
And as you get older, there's comfort in these old hymns, you know. Because you've sung them all your life, I suppose. And when you get near the end, they give you a bit of comfort.
Oh.
Anyway, my mother.
Yeah, I'm crying here.
But my mother used to sing beautiful things, you know. She had a lovely voice, my mother. My father could only perform in concerts if he had a chair to put his foot on. He used to hold onto the back of a chair and do a monologue. That was his party piece.
But his knee would tremble otherwise.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he had all the legs, which would shake. Thought he'd play the castanet. But my mum had a lovely contralto voice. And one of her favourite hymns, and one of mine, was How Sweet the Name of Jesus Sounds. Beautiful hymn, that is.
How Sweet the Name of Jesus Sounds, sung by the London Emmanuel Choir, conducted by Muriel Shepherd. So Lance Bombardier Seacombe was sent to the front in North Africa in 1942. How close did you come to catching it?
Well, we were in action for a long time. We were a sort of infantry assault brigade. So we went in. We were 25 Thunder Regiment. We went into Algiers in November 42, then pushed ahead to try to get to Tunis before the Germans got there, because they were coming from the other side. You know, the 8th Army was in the desert, and we were coming through. We nearly made it, but we got caught at a place called Taborba, about 5 miles from Tunis, and we had a bit of a shock there. We had to get out rather quickly.
Did you, I mean, did you ever feel real fear? Did you ever?
Most of the time, yes. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to explain to anybody who's never been in action. I mean, that's why regimental reunions are held, because you can only sort of come to terms with it by talking over it with people who've been through it with you. It's amazing to start with when you go into action for the first time before you know anything about it. There's a kind of bloodlust. You get quite excited, and because you're firing at them. Once they start firing back at you, it's a different matter altogether. Because I remember once having to obey a call of nature, and something went over my head, and I turned around, and there was a hole in a cactus thing behind me, and my first instinct was to get up and say, "Hey, be careful," and I realised they really meant it. And from then on, your attitude changes.
Yeah.
It's a personal thing. Yeah. Funny that.
You grow up a bit quicker.
You grow up rather quickly, Keep your head down.
And you met a man called Milligan.
I met a man called Milligan. Oh, God. They were... Germans were dug in very deeply into a hill near a place called Oizaga. And they wouldn't come out. We'd ask them all, you know, nicely, and left choppers behind for them, but they wouldn't come out. So there was a plateau in front of it, and then a steep cliff and a sort of road. So to get them out, they brought in very heavy guns, 7.2 gun howitzers, which are enormous things with hydraulics and big rubber wheels. And we dug gun pits to the specifications given to us, which were wrong. They were too small. So when they brought these guns in at night time, they put the first one into the pit, and they fired on a lanyard. They got a bit of rope attached to the firing mechanism, stand back and pull it. And when they turned around, the gun had gone. But it just jumped out of this gun pit over this cliff. And we were in a wireless truck at the bottom of it, an 800-watt wireless truck. And this thing came over and missed us by just a couple of feet. Pandemonium broke out, because we thought, you know, if they're firing guns instead of shells, it's time we packed it in, folks. And I was looking up to the dictionary for, "I'm on your side" in German. The flap of the truck opened, and this face, "Can anybody see the gun?" He was Milligan, of course. "What car are we firing?" And he says he's still paying for it. And that's how it all began for us.
Record number four.
Great voice. This is Gordon McRae singing "If I Loved You" from Rodgers and Hammerstein and that Carousel. It's an example to me of how to sing a ballad properly. And of course, the words are so good. And when you get the words and music coming together so beautifully, it's a rare thing.
If I love you, time and again I would try to say.
embracing me, if I love having the loves and hands not long after into the wind, says, out of the wall, into the dim light, some tearing, carrying, scrambling, not long on the silver and the sleeves of my white wheels, my old God-fearing man, the stones of the pen, I mean, the stones of the sleeves, the total operation, if it were not to have the moment, was it, and it is any home, there are all three things, the total operation, the moment is to the side, the
you'd meet in the radio.
Yeah, I met him on a thing called Listen My Children, which was written by Muir and Norden. Mm. Very avant-garde, very funny comedy he was. And I got Peter to come down the Grafton, so we always get together and throw these ideas about.
So eventually the four of you said that, you know, yeah, there's a seed of a good idea, more than the seed of a good idea here, let's sell it to the radio. Let's
it took a bit of time to get BBC to accept it. Eventually they give us a pilot to do. And in their infinite wisdom, they gave us a series.
Meantime, you'd gone to Blackpool and were kind of second spot.
I was, hello, folks, yes. That air of desperate gaiety coming out there. You know.
But give me an idea of how you put the Goon Show together, because it was a Sunday. You'd come down from Blackpool in your little Austin 7.
I'd come down little Austin, yeah, Austin 10. Ostentatious, we used to call it. Oh, God. Come down overnight, go to see Jimmy Grafton, have bacon and egg for breakfast. Then go along to Manlio's, have an hour's lesson. Then off to rehearse the Goon Show. The first thing we did was the read-through, where we'd all fall about and exchange jokes and all the rest of it. Then they do it with the orchestra, and then orchestra effects, and then do it.
Mm.
And in the end,
in front of an audience?
Yes, in the front of an audience. And there's a queue for it. There's a queue outside for quite a way. Just to get into the...
But you had a script, a tight script, or did you ad-lib within it?
Originally, it was all done on disc, so they couldn't edit that. You had to keep the time, and you had to keep the script. I'd blow around here and there or something, but really it was scripted and had to be, you know, BBC assisted on it.
Mostly by Milligan.
Mostly by Spy, and Larry Stevens at the beginning.
Mm.
And, because Eric Sykes wrote quite a few when Spike wasn't there. It was a very funny one, Eric.
But eventually you did start to ad-lib.
Well, yes, when tape came in, when we recorded on tape, we could edit it. Would you like to? Sometimes Min and Hen would go on out with me forever, and I'd come in quickly and say, come on, lads, let's break it up and get on with the show.
But a sound engineer's nightmare, because so much of it, as you said, you were creating a kind of verbal cartoon, so you had all these sound effects.
That was the thing. We had about three turntables with records going around, and the balls are going from one to the other. Spike was a stickler of having the effects dead right.
Mm.
That was one thing. Yeah.
And as you said, people used to queue to come and hear this thing. And much later on, because of course people have gone on loving the Goons, most famously Prince Charles, who wanted to be a Goon. Didn't
he does all the voices. Mm-hmm. He's very good at the voices. He really is.
He was besotted with you, wasn't he?
He's still a great fan. I get letters from him now and again, sort of Spike, keep in touch with him.
Yeah.
But I once heard him do all these voices. All of us together met at Sellers Place for lunch one day when he was at Cambridge. And it was wild. He did all these impressions. He could do Eccles and Blue Bottle and Crun. And I said to him, you know, if anything happened to your lot, God forbid, you could join us. You'll be air today and Goon tomorrow. And he said, it's very drafty in the tower this time of year. And then he said...
Tell me about your next piece of music.
This is a great piece of music. I've done it myself a few times, but this is beautiful. It's done by Richard Tucker and Robert Merrill with just piano. It's that famous, wonderful duet from the Pearl Fishers by Bizet.
Come on.
Richard Tucker and Robert Merrill singing part of the duet au fond du Temple Saint from Act One of Bizet's The Pearlfishers, recorded at the Carnegie Hall with George Schick at the piano.
Hello, George.
Harry Secombe, you've had some health scares in your time, not least being told that you only had 2 years to live. How did that happen?
Well, I'd actually had a perforated colon. I was suffering from punctuation, you understand. So this was in Barbados. I had an operation, and during the operation they found that I also had diabetes, and I was pretty ill. I mean, I had peritonitis, and the surgeon told Myra that it was touch and go before the operation. He said it's 50-50 or 60-40 or something.
Because you're also, 19 or 20?
I was 19 stone,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was 6'3" when I was 12, and I was hit by a lift, you understand. The old ones are best, I don't know.
But anyway, you ended up performing again in Australia, and
yes.
All of a sudden...
And then because I hadn't really taken care of myself, I hadn't really got down to dieting or anything, I did a concert at the Opera House in Sydney with a big orchestra and a big choir and everything. And normally at the end of these things, I'm elated, you know, you're on a high. But this time I came off, I felt terrible. And the impresario, Dennis Smith, took me down to see this doctor in Woolloomooloo, who gave me a good going over and said, Harry, I'll give you 2 years at the most if you keep this up. And he frightened the life out of me. He said, you know, stop drinking, stop eating too much, and take it easier.
So what happened then once you got frightened?
Well, Myra said, you've got to, you know, she'd take me in hand, and she did, and... I went on a diet.
Yes, you were a large person to take it, sorry.
Yes, you were. Took me by the throat. And eventually, in about 6 months, I'd lost about 3 stone. And in the end, I lost 5 stone altogether. Hmm. It's playing Bradford this week, you understand.
Record number 6.
Now, this is a bloke with a mate of mine and a lovely singer. He hasn't been too well lately, but I think he's coming on nicely. Beautiful voice, a real Welsh tenor, lyric tenor. He does a wonderful diminuendo. He can really, really use his voice properly.
Last night I lay asleeping, there came a dream so fair. I stood in old Jerusalem beside the temple there. I heard the children singing, and ever as they sang, methought the voice of angels from heaven in answer rang. Methought the voice of angels from heaven in answer rang.
Holy City, sung by Stuart Burrows with the Ambrosian Singers, accompanied by the organist Martin Neary. It wasn't long after that illness and the dieting, mm-hmm. Harry Secombe, that you began presenting religious programmes, you know, Highway for ITV, you did for 10 years. But were the two things linked in some way? Did it sort of stop you in your tracks?
Yeah. I mean, I was having, as I say, felt the brush of the angel's wing. You do reassess your life, I think. You look back and think, well, you know, don't be such a twit. Think of your family and your responsibilities. And when this came up, Bill Ward wrote to me. Bill Ward used to be, I knew him from the time as a floor manager until he became a chief executive with ATV. And they retired, and he wrote this letter to me saying that he wanted to talk about a program. And we had lunch together, and he brought up the idea of Highway.
Mm.
And I said, you know, am I the right bloke to do it?
It's a long way from gooning to the God spot.
That's it, yes, from goon to guru. So I thought, well, I'll have a go anyway, so let's try. So we did 6, and I got to like it very much indeed. Meeting ordinary people are an extraordinary thing. Turning the spotlight on people in the community, you know, unsung saints within the community. That I found very interesting, because I wasn't aware of so many people doing good out there, quietly, without thought of reward or anything. Because in our business, we do good deeds with an ear-splitting stealth, don't we? Let's face it. But you meet these people, and you meet people who are completely committed to helping others, you know, and you become humble in the process.
More music.
Ah, this is a lovely old friend of mine, Kiriti Kanawa. She did her first appearance on television with me after when she came over from New Zealand. And we got on very well together. She had this beautiful voice, this beautiful girl. But I couldn't pronounce her name. Kiri, I can do it now, Kiriti Kanawa. So I had a few stabs at it. She said, "Just call me Tim Mikazari," she said. So I thought, here's a kindred soul.
Kiriti Kanawa singing part of Bailero from Canteloube's Songs of the Auvergne with the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by Geoffrey Tate. You celebrated 50 years in show business last year, Harry, and 50 years of marriage coming up next
February
year.
February 19th.
You claim that you and Myra have never had a row and that you've never lost your... I mean, you sound like some kind of saint.
No, not at all. No, we laugh a lot. And I make all the big decisions, you know, whether we go to war with China or buy any more missiles. And she decides the little things like what's for lunch and what schools the kids go to.
She's been your mainstay.
She has. She's great. She really is.
And
marvelous.
She's back in the wings now with the towel and the glass of water.
Always there. When I was doing my bit, doing the act, she'd be there in the wings. I dragged her on one night in New Zealand. I did a final concert of Austria and New Zealand. Dragged her on stage and she stood there. God bless her. Tremendous ovation she got. She deserves it.
Now, you can't take her to your desert island. You're going to be all alone.
Oh.
Can you... You can make yourself like... You can keep your own pecker up.
I would have talked to coconut trees or whatever. I don't know. I'm a gregarious bloke. You know, I like to be on my own now and again, as we all do. But I like people.
Tell me about your last record.
Whenever I go abroad, especially on my own, I like to play Green Sleeves. It reminds me of the view from my window at home. I can see it's right across the Wheeler Sussex to the South Downs. Beautiful, rolling hills and trees and lakes and things. And this music reminds me of it all. So I can feel that I've brought it with me.
Thank you.
part of Fantasia on Green Sleeves, arranged by Vaughan Williams, played by the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Eugene Ormandy. Which one of those eight records, Harry, if you could only take one?
I'll take the Green Sleeves, because it'll remind me of home.
Now, the Bible's there, and the complete works of Shakespeare are there. What about your book?
I'd like to take Pickwick's Papers, because I've done it. I've done played the part long enough. Singing top C's, going puce in the process, but great fun.
And what about your luxury on this island?
I'd like to take a guitar. Can't play an instrument, you see. And I can't sing, you know, sing to myself. So I'd like to learn to play the guitar so I can accompany myself as I wander around singing little bits and pieces. What can I sing all through the night? That would keep the natives awake, wouldn't it?
Sir Harry Seacombe, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
It's been a pleasure.